For the week of January 1st, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 349, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, wondering if I still have a job, it's Michael Gills.
What do you mean, if you still have a job? That confuses me.
Well, we didn't work over the holidays, and of course, most people didn't. But it felt like people found out they weren't going to be working even after the holidays. That happened a lot in Hollywood over the break.
What are you talking about? Are you talking about the head of Paramount?
Relativity. I'm talking about Miramax. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about, you know, you Viacom. You name it. First, Relativity. What happened there?
Well, Ryan Kavanaugh, of course, he is the head of Relativity, the founder of Relativity, and a lot of people say, look, he drove it into the ground. He borrowed too much money. His slate financing plan never really worked out. He picked the wrong movies. They went and filed for bankruptcy. Then they brought in Dana Brunetti, who is a producer working with Kevin Spacey, who, you know, he produced The Social Network and other films. And now they're both gone.
And the employees were told over the holidays, enjoy your break. We're not going to pay you.
Right.
Which is never an encouraging sign if you're an employee.
Right. Congratulations. You get 2 weeks off. By the way, don't look for a check in the mail.
And when you come back, we don't know what will be here.
Right.
I mean, Obviously, the two guys are gone there. It looks very bad for Relativity. Miramax, their CEO is gone too, isn't he?
Yes, Stephen. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Stephen Scoach or Sko? I don't know.
And Viacom, they're still doing their house cleaning. Doug Herzog is out.
Yeah, that I kind of expected. I think everybody expects Viacom to be cleaned out. And the head of was Doug Herzog? Yeah, no, it was Doug Herzog, the head of the television, right?
Yeah, I mean, he oversaw, you know, MTV and VH1 and Logo and Comedy Central and all that sort of stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, and he had a good run. I mean, The Daily Show and South Park were all done under his watch.
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, well, apparently he's not going to be doing much.
The only good thing the only good news over the holidays, other than big box office, was that the DGA and the producers seemed to have reached an agreement. So that's good. We've got a little information about that, but at least that strike, you know, wasn't even close. But it looks like they're going to have an agreement. There will be no strike. Wasn't much of a threat of one, but it's always good when people can get to an early agreement and move forward with business and not have to worry about that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we'll have a little bit more about that later in the show.
What else are we going to talk about?
Well, it's been 2 weeks, okay? So it might be because of me. And on this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll catch up on all the box office news that happened while I was gallivanting around the country. We've got smash hits, a record box office in North America, which is great, and a record box office in China, which wasn't so great, or not great enough. Also, AMC Theaters finally reached an agreement with the Justice Department about its takeover of the Carmike cinema chain here in the United States. During our book filter segment, Michael will reveal his latest pick of a book ripe for development by Hollywood. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the theater industry, and by theater I mean Broadway, revel in their end-of-year record grosses, and then put Michael on the hot seat by looking at 16 big shows about to open this spring and ask him one simple question. Will you invest or not invest in any of these shows? So one by one, we'll go through them. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Shouldn't you be the entertainment journalist extraordinaire since you actually do journalism?
Well, so do you.
I do reviews and I'm a freelancer. You actually get paid. You cover. You have a beat.
Well, okay. Yeah. But I guess technically a critic is considered a journalist, no?
I guess. Anyway, we're looking at the box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, another $110 million over this four-day weekend here in North America. Because of the new year, we've got box office figures for Monday as well tallied in. This movie's made a lot of money, of course, since we last spoke, $800 million worldwide, barreling along, just doing great. At number two around the world is Sing, the animated film, another big hit, $80 million over the weekend, $280 million worldwide, and it is tearing it up. I mean, it's catching up to Moana. So Disney's doing great. They get good reviews, but they have to be looking at Illumination going, wow, half the price or a third of the price, and they are churning it out. They are making some serious coin, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is that it's not just that it's they're making big bank, because, of course, you can do that with family films, you know, especially over the holidays. But it's the fact that, you know, Moana costs, what, $200 million to produce and market, whereas Sing kind of comes in at a cool $75 to produce and probably another $25, $35 to market.
I don't think that means the movie people that make Moana are bloated, or that there's too many people, or they're spending too much money, because they are, by and large, very profitable. And you create a more valuable library when you create better movies with more artistic, enduring standards. Some of Illumination's movies have gotten pretty good reviews, probably most notably The Secret Life of Pets. Most of the others, they've made money, they've sold toys, but they're not movies that people really love, or certainly not critics. So whether their worth will be the same 20 or 40 years from now, that's another question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I always wonder, like Pinocchio, the reason we still talk about Pinocchio is it was a great movie. Right?
It's a masterpiece. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't a great movie because it was marketed well and the Pinocchio toys sold for decades. Whereas the Minions, you look at them and you kind of go, and Despicable Me, okay, the first movie was cute. The second movie, not so much, not as much. And then the Minions movie, nobody really seemed to like critically, but it still made a mint. And you kind of wonder, will we be looking at Despicable Me because it just kept getting jammed down our throat for 30 years? Or because it's a good movie? I don't necessarily know that. I think it will be the former rather than the latter. I think it's going to be the latter rather than.
I think they're doing a great job. They're making good money. They are creating popular movies. They are selling merchandise. They're adding a good, valuable thing to their library. I just don't want to point to Disney and say, ah, they're doing it wrong. They should be cheaper. That's not necessarily the lesson to take, but it can be done cheaper, and you can make money and make fans happy. Speaking of classic Disney films, Tyrus Wong was one of the many people who died over the holidays. We'll get to that in the obits. He was a Chinese-born American artist, hugely important in the look of Bambi, perhaps Disney's greatest animated film. What a gorgeous movie that is, if you haven't seen it in a while. And he never quite got the attention he deserved because he's Asian, and they didn't want that as the face of Disney animation. So happily, on his passing, people have remembered him and celebrated the work that he did for Disney.
Yeah, just to give you some sense as to how important this person was, okay, and this animator was, and this artist was, he got a front page obituary on the New York Times.
Fair enough. Back to the box office. At number three around the world is our first flop. It's Passengers, starring Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. $42 million over the weekend, $125 million worldwide, but it's falling hard everywhere it's already playing. People really don't like this movie. The word of mouth is poisonous. So we'll see where it ends up. They're stars. They've already sort of matched the budget, but you want to triple it. It's not a good story for Passengers. At number four is that Disney film Moana, another $35 million over the weekend. It passes the $400 million mark, and it's got a long ways to go. It's got a lot of overseas potential to come. It's only playing in 29 markets. At number five, another flop. Hit, flop, hit, flop. This one is Assassin's Creed, based on a video game that's never easy to do. $32 million over the weekend, $86 million worldwide. Dreadful reviews. No one seems to like it. At number six is The Great Wall, the Chinese epic fantasy with, is it Matt Damon?
Yes.
Yes, it's Matt Damon. $25 million over the weekend, $150 million. Has it playing here in North America yet? I forget.
I think it has, or it's coming out.
I mean, Matt Damon's a big star. It should have a better play here. I think maybe it hasn't. So it's in eight territories. It's at $150 million. That's what it cost to make. This was a very expensive movie, but it's clearly got a lot of potential in a lot more Asian markets and around the world with Matt Damon in it. We'll have to see where it ends up. Speaking of China, Some Like It Hot, nothing to do with the Marilyn Monroe movie. This is a very light Chinese rom-com, and it opened over the weekend, and it's made $22 million so far. And number eight is the James Franco comedy, Why Him? $23 million over the weekend, $52 million and counting. Sort of dumb comedy counter-programming to play against all the big, fat, you know, end-of-the-year spectacles. We'll have to see if they make their coin back. But at number nine is one of the Oscar hopefuls. It's La La Land, $18 million over the weekend, $65 million and counting. This is one of two or three movies that is really positioning itself well to make a lot of money off end of the year awards, Oscar potential, reach its audience. It's sort of a classic platform release.
Yeah, especially starting with all the way back in September with Telluride in Toronto. So doing the film festivals, getting some buzz, kind of waiting a few months, then slowly releasing it, not all at once, but a little bit here, then a little bit wider, the next week or two, then after the new year, going wide.
That's right. And number 10 is Fantastic Beasts, the launch of another franchise, $14 million over the weekend, $777 million worldwide. That's, we're taking that for granted. That's making about $800 million, just the way most of the Harry Potter movies did. That's a really big accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that Warner Brothers is disappointed that it didn't make $1 billion, that they, you know, because now is a billion the new 100 million? There was a point where if you didn't make $100 million with your movie in the you know, mid to late 80s, then you were a failure, even though making, you know, $90 million on a $30 million budget was great.
I don't think so. They may be, but they're beginning a new franchise and they've set it up well. The next one could become bigger.
And frankly, I think it's the best Harry Potter movie I've ever seen.
Well, I think Prisoner of Azkaban is probably better, but there you go.
Okay. Yeah, actually, yeah, I take it back. Yes. I would say those two are definitely the best of the bunch.
None of them are that good. They're certainly not as good as the books. And number 11 is Master. This is a South Korean crime drama about a police squad that busts corporate fraud. It made $11 million over the weekend, and it's at $32 million and counting. And number 12, another movie new to us. It's a Chinese Hong Kong rom-com called See You Tomorrow. It's about the owner of a bar and his lonely customers. It sounds like a very broad mainstream movie. It was written and produced by Wong Kar-wai.
Oh, wow.
And it's directed by the author of the novel it's based on. He's a first-time filmmaker named Jiang Xia Xia. I don't know how to say his name. It's very difficult. I apologize. Yeah. It's hard for me. $10 million over the weekend, $60 million in counting. We don't know what it cost, but an interesting project for Wong Kar-wai to be involved in. And number 13, another Oscar hopeful, it's Fences, the Denzel Washington movie. This is doing well as well. $12 million over the weekend, $32 million and counting. So again, another platform release, another movie positioning itself very well for end of the year awards and Oscar potential.
I guess you don't want to talk about Collateral Beauty. Hey, who does?
Neither does Will Smith.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, that is one of the flops of the season. $9 million over the weekend, $47 million worldwide. It's a year where he's had one of his worst performing movies ever. He's also had one of his best performing movies ever with Suicide Squad. So the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away at the box office. And number 15 is another bad movie that's not doing great at the box office. It's Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard in Allied, the World War II romantic drama. $5 million over the weekend, $85 million worldwide. I watched an Oscar screener with a friend who's supposed to have them, so we're not breaking any rules. And oh my God, it's not a good movie, but it has one of the most amazing birth scenes I've ever seen. I mean, I was howling with laughter, so I don't recommend seeing the movie, but if you've got the disc and want to fast forward to the birth scene, it is pretty hilarious.
What about time code? Do you have the hour, minute, and second that the scene appears so that we can skip right to it?
Shame on me. I don't. Maybe I'll get that to you next week.
Okay. All right.
And number 16, another Oscar hopeful, Hacksaw Ridge. This is popping up on end of the year list. I didn't think that would happen, but Andrew Garfield, because the Scorsese movie Silence has done so poorly and has really not been embraced by a lot of people. It doesn't mean it won't get some Oscar love, but it doesn't have critical or popular support, though it is Marty. So, you know, people may vote anyway because they respect him as an artist. But that means Andrew Garfield isn't competing with himself. So his work in Hacksaw Ridge looks more and more likely to get an Oscar nomination. It made $5 million over the weekend, $140 million worldwide. At number 17 is Office Christmas Party. That's at $90 million worldwide. And number 18, another new movie, Cherry Returns, which sounds like an adult softcore movie, but it's a Hong Kong thriller about a little girl returned to her family 12 years after being kidnapped. And it's directed by Chris Chow and had a modest opening weekend of $4.4 million. And seeing if there's any new movies we haven't talked about. Manchester by the Sea is also platforming well. That's at $30 million worldwide. And, oh, here's an interesting movie.
I know before you even mention it, can I tell you what I think it is?
Okay.
It's the Brazilian movie?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I knew it. My mom is a character too.
My mom is a character too, part two. It's a sequel. This is clearly modeled after Madea.
Yes.
It's co-written and starring Paulo Gustavo. He plays a fast-talking, crazy divorced mom who is overbearing with her children. She's hilarious. I've watched the trailer. There were no subtitles, and I laughed. But he runs around playing the mom. He's hilarious. He's funny. He's outspoken. He's brash. The 2013 original was the most popular Brazilian film of the year. Huge, huge hit. Like Madea, it started as a stage play by the same guy, Paulo Gustavo, whose full name in classic Latin fashion is Paulo Gustavo Amare Monteiro de Barros.
Which means, come and see my movie, please.
Exactly. It made $3 million over the weekend. It's at $6 million and counting. That's purely from Brazil. I'm not quite sure how those numbers rank at the box office for Brazil. We'll have to see where it
really
ends
good.
Up if it does well.
Hmm? It's really good.
Yeah, I imagine it is. We'll have to see where it ends up. But my mother is a character, too.
Remember, there's only 3,000 movie screens there, and it can't be playing on all of them. So,
and maybe playing on a lot of them, though.
That's true.
Looking down, we've got another big flop. The studio's already written off. That's Paramount, this movie. It's Monster Trucks. It opened to $2.8 million in two territories. Not a good launch for Lucas Till, but he will survive and perhaps get a chance with another better movie. And then finally, Yolki 5. This is interesting, too. This is a Russian film. It's sort of a New Year's Eve film. It's all based around New Year's Eve and the idea of, you know, new chances, new possibility, hope, optimism. This is the fifth in the series. It grossed $2 million over the weekend and $6 million total. I guess since it's a New Year's Eve film, maybe people won't care anymore now that we're in the new year. I don't know if it's like Christmas, where if you're Christmas-themed December 26th, no one wants to see you. But that's the thing of this film. But it's directed by Timur Bekmambetov, who people know because he made a big stir for himself with Night Watch, came to Hollywood, and he's made a lot of junk since then.
Well, Abe Wanted.
Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, Ben-Hur. He's produced movies that haven't done well. So he's looking for a hit, and he's back in Russia making Yolki 5. Obviously, people think he has talent. He made some movies that caught attention and did well internationally. If he can get his mojo back, maybe this is the start. And finally, I guess they re-released this, the Jackie Chan movie, Railroad Tigers. That got another few play in a few new territories, another $2 million. That's at $66 million worldwide. It's Jackie Chan, but the movie did cost, we think, about $50 million to make. So that's not quite enough.
Yeah, no. But you know what was enough? Was the amount of money earned at the North American box office this year. And what I mean by that is certainly more would be better, but this year's box office in 2016 beat out 2015's box office, which everybody thought wasn't going to happen. So in 2015, North America earned $11.13 billion. That was a new record. This year, another record was broken, or I should say 2016, another record was broken, $11.4 billion. So it was kind of squeaking past last year, 2015's record.
Yeah, but there's no squeaking past when you set a new record. You set the all-time record, the biggest box office of all time in North America and presumably worldwide, and it's not enough. Hollywood wants every movie to be a hit. They're bitching and moaning, and their complaint is that, yeah, made a lot of money, but more of that money is concentrated in fewer and fewer films. There's no bottom. There's no basement. If you release a film these days, it can collapse and disappear in a minute, even if you have big stars and you do a big ad campaign. So they're worried about that. It's hard to feel sympathy if you make a really bad movie and it doesn't make money, right?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like the record industry when they put out like 300 albums. They realize, okay, look, 10 of these albums are going to be huge blockbusters and pay for the rest. But it's kind of, that's exactly what's happening now with studios, is that you have a movie like Passengers, which they're going to hope barely breaks even at the box office. And in the end, other bigger movies will actually make the studio a profit.
So do you agree that there's more movies that are just collapsing completely, that you're not getting away with being able to get at least an opening weekend, or you can't make money in another country because the word has already spread thanks to social media that it was a flop in this country or that country? So you can't open in Spain or France or Japan and make money because they're like, oh, that's a bad movie.
Well, I'm going to go with a couple things here to answer your question. Yes, movies are just collapsing immediately. That is due to, in part, the Rotten Tomatoes effect, social media effect, at least here in North America. Now, talking about word traveling, yes, it does. It always has. It just travels a lot more efficiently and a lot faster and a lot more succinctly. It can be checked easier. So anybody can check Rotten Tomatoes. If you're in France, you can check it, the Rotten Tomatoes here in the U.S. If you're in China, the same thing. So I would say, much like we hear about The Great Wall, we hear about Your Name. These are, one's a Chinese production, one's a Japanese production, and we want to see them here because we've heard interesting things about those movies. You know, the same is true for American films and North American films being released overseas.
Well, they always hear about them. It's just a question of whether they hear that they're not good or that they flopped. And yes, that's the problem. Of course, they're going to hear about big, fat Hollywood movies.
Right. But and now they're hearing more and more, oh, it didn't do well. I mean, box office has become a blood sport and something that seems to be newsworthy. So now, of course, they're hearing about that. And it's easier to check.
It's hard. And again, it's just hard to feel, you know what, if it just didn't work, thinking, well, we should be able to make $150 million anyway. It's like, well, yeah, no.
Yeah, that's
it's I know it's not easy. You don't have that cushion of DVD and Blu-ray anymore where you used to make more money there than the box office. You don't have the cushion of overseas box office where you know you can make a certain amount of money. You just can't, you don't have no guarantees anymore, and that's a little scary. But I don't think that's a problem that can be fixed. I think it's just the new world that we live in.
I would agree with that. And I think, you know, sure. I mean, this is why you see all of these, you know, superhero movies, because, you know, you can get away with making a bad movie and still have it make $1 billion. Look at Batman versus Superman. I mean, there they had two superheroes and the movie, okay, it was panned critically and it didn't help launch new franchises, but it kind of made money.
Well, it did launch. It's launching Wonder Woman. We'll see how she does in the summer.
True.
Right. And of course, the one studio that is totally happy with the box office is Disney. $7 billion worldwide in 1 year. Four movies crossed the $1 billion mark, and frankly, five if you count, you know, Zootopia. The Jungle Book, which is just a smidge below. They had four of the top five films domestically. I think seven of the top 10 or six of the top 10 domestically in North America. I mean, they're just tearing it up. And so they think, we've solved the problem. We can always make hit movies. We'll never not have hits.
Wrong. Just wait 10 years and we'll see where you are.
Yes, but you know, they've got it going. They've got Marvel, they've got Star Wars, they've got Pixar and their own Disney animation. So boy, oh boy, every 3 or 4 or 5 months, they've got a big, big movie. And those movies are being released in China because China is someday soon going to become the biggest box office market in the world. It's just not going to happen in 2017.
Right. Everybody started moving that bar closer and closer to 2016. You remember that? Like, you know,
of course,
first it was going to be 20.
The box office was growing by 80% and then 50%. It was growing by leaps and bounds.
Right. I mean, you know, I remember it was going to be 2020 and then it kind of moved up to 2019, maybe 2018. And then last year it was in 2017, it will definitely surpass the Chinese box office will surpass North American box office. But you and I kept saying one thing, look, you keep building movie theaters, which is fine. That's great. In fact, now China, as of December 19th, has more movie screens, commercial movie screens, than North America, which used to have.
And they should.
Correct, because they have more people, so they have to serve more people. Now, that said, you know, again, North America used to have the most movie screens, and now it's China. You still, if you're building stores and you're stocking it with shelves, you need something to put on those shelves. And there was this quota of 34 films. There still is a quota of 34 films coming into the country. They need more films. They need more films. So whether they're homegrown or imported, they need to stock those shelves with more product.
All right. So first, let's talk about the box office.
Okay.
What happened? How much did the box office fall? It almost fell in 2016. Forget growing. In 2015, it grew 50%. In 2016, it almost fell. And
right.
In fact, the second half of the year, it did fall compared to 2015. So what happened ultimately at the box office?
Well, the first half was fine. I mean, I guess growth had slowed, but it hadn't slowed as much as, you know, 3%. In the second half of the year, as you mentioned, it was down compared to 2015.
That's right. The last 4 months were all down compared to 2015. So the final result was that the Chinese box office rose just 3%. If it had not risen at all, that really would have been a PR problem for a country that was boasting and talking about how they were going to grow by leaps and bounds. And in fact, ticket sales are up, so it's not all bad news. They've moved into smaller markets. They're in tier 3 and tier 4 markets. These are smaller cities, rural areas, where they can't charge the same prices that they charge in, you know, big cities like Beijing and Shanghai.
That's
just
right.
Like New York and LA pay $15, and you go to the Heartland, you pay $8, and you've got matinees. Guess what? That's what they're doing in China. And that's why ticket sales increased by 9%. That's good news. Ticket prices fell because of multiple reasons, but the big one being they're in smaller markets.
Well, and they also fell because all of a sudden in the bigger markets, these mobile ticketing apps, which had been subsidizing the ticket prices, they stopped doing that. They gained their market share. They didn't need to attract new customers. They, basically came down to two or three of them, even though there were like something to the effect of 25. So they just stopped. And so ticket prices literally doubled, even though they were never reduced by half. They were only subsidized by half.
Right. So it's good. There's good news. The box office still rose. Ticket sales increased by 9%. That's great news for long term. You're building the habit of people going to the movies. That's what you want. But clearly, this is not a happy thing for China. What did they do? How did they react? And this, I think, is where the real news is. Everybody knows their box office is slowing down. They're not done growing yet, they don't think. We'll have to see what happens in 2017. But they've taken steps, haven't they?
Yes, and this is what I guess I was putting the cart before the horse, because this is really what I was talking about, is that, if you see that you're not selling as much of the product, you need more product, you start lifting bans or blackouts or quotas. And so they lifted the blackout on Hollywood films during July and August. So that means The Secret Life of Pets was able to be released. Tarzan, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was released. Right. They did the same thing in December.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are several periods of the year where they say no international films, because it's the biggest peak period of the year and they want their Chinese films to have no competition. That used to be in the middle of the summer, July and August, and in December, and also around some key holidays. And those blackout periods, they lifted like they did in July and August. And then what movies came out in December during the so-called blackout period?
Well, Sully, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, and Japan had a film, Your Name. This is one of the films that I'd love to see here in the U.S. All those films got really good December slots.
That's right. So this is where you can make the most money in the year. So again, what day of the week did they open? How many screens did they open on? All that stuff matters as well. But the fact that those two big blackout periods, which are, of course, unofficial, they don't actually admit that they do it, but you can watch the scheduling and see it, that ended. They said, you know what? This is when people are going to the movies. We need to get some good product in here. Not that their movies aren't good, but you just want a better mix. There's no reason not to have them in the mix. You want people to come to the movies, show them the movies they want to see.
Right.
And there's another thing beyond the blackout period is the quota. What is the quota in China?
Well, as I mentioned previously, 34 imported films per year. Now, almost all of them, if not all of them entirely, are Hollywood blockbusters, at least historically.
Right. So that was a firm rule. And so every studio jostled and fought to try to become one of those 34 films. They would do co-production with Chinese companies to try and help guarantee it, get somebody on their side. And even then it didn't always work. So they were always jumping through hoops to become one of those 34 films released in China in an off month, sometimes competing against each other to have the deck stacked against them. I mean, this is the crazy stuff that they got to deal with. What happened this year? That went out the window, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to figure out just before we started the show how many films were actually released, and it's hard to know whether, a film was a co-production, so it fell outside the quota or inside the quota, and was a film from, say, France or Germany or Brazil. It's kind of hard to know all of that. But we counted roughly 45 films instead of 34. Again, we could be off, but still, it's more than 34, which is kind of what we're getting at here.
Yeah, there's no question that more than 34 international films were released, including ones that didn't qualify in some sort of backdoor way. China says, no, no, no. Those were cultural exchanges. We didn't lift the quota. Those are just cultural exchange projects. Yes, of course, whatever. So they can call it whatever they want. But the fact is, they lifted the quota, at least this time. They need movies, they want movies, and they got movies.
Right.
And so that's a big, big change. And in 2017, again, Hollywood studios, when you're looking for better margins, now's the time to talk. You want better release dates, less competition, better margins on the box office to try to bring it up closer to what you get in North America. Now's the time to use your power, because they need your movies.
There's a reason that that economic theory exists, and it's playing itself out in this particular market.
And we say it because it's easy to say rather than actually making it happen.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
There's distribution news here in the U.S. as well, right? AMC finally got to their merger agreement.
Well, that's more of exhibition news.
I mean, exhibition. I always get the distributors or the studios.
Correct.
I always get that wrong.
And exhibitors are those that actually show the movies, movie theater chains, mm-hmm. or movie theaters.
And what happened with AMC?
Well, AMC Theaters has been on a tear. I mean, first off, they're owned by Wanda. So the Wanda Delian Group out of China owns AMC. They bought AMC back in, I don't know, 2012, I believe. And they then AMC then bought the largest European chain, Odeon and UCI. Now, you know, they have AMC in the US. AMC now owns Odeon overseas. They made a play earlier in the year for Carmike Cinemas, the fourth or fifth largest chain in the United States. But the problem was that it would just give AMC theaters so many screens and so much market clout that the Justice Department had to get involved and approve the merger. They did that, but with concessions.
Right. So they're selling theaters in 15 markets. They're divesting all links to national CineMedia, and they're handing over. I don't know what that means, handing over. Like, give me one if you're going to hand stuff over. But they're handing over 24 theaters, roughly about 380 screens, to Screen Vision Media. I don't know why they say handing over instead of selling, but those are the conditions, or at least the main bullet points that the Justice Department forced on them.
Well, I can, you know, having listened to the conference call and following that particular story, I can tell you the reason that it's not selling is Screen Vision Media and National CineMedia, they do not own movie theaters, okay? So they are the pre-show advertising. When you go in and you see advertising, that's all they do. So they have contracts and long-term contracts. I mean, like 30-year contracts with specific circuits and specific screens. So if a specific theater. So if a theater chain is purchased, very often those screens will have to remain on the old contract.
With the previous deal. Okay.
Right. And so what's happening here is National CineMedia is the pre-show advertising company started by Cinemark and AMC and Regal. And because of that, they're all founding members. And so what the Justice Department said is, look, you can't have any... You can't control NCM anymore, and you can't have
a piece of this pre-show advertising, and now they can't.
Correct. And so now they're going to have to, over time, sell down to about 4.9% I think it's 4.9% of NCM, and they will wind up owning about 20% of Screen Vision. Basically, the Justice Department wanted to make sure that there was going to be some competition in the pre-show advertising space. That's really what's going on.
Are those the two main companies?
Those are the two main companies. And frankly, if there are others,
they're pretty much it. So if we wanted to be that chick or that guy that goes, hey, thanks for joining us. We're talking about the late, you know, if we want to be one of those people, we got to get a job through them.
Right. And what I will say here is, you know, this always happens with mergers of like supermarkets and retail outlets. When the Justice Department says, okay, you can merge, but in City X, where you happen to be competing, where you both have movie theaters, you have to sell one of those movie theaters. What do you think AMC does? Do you think AMC says, hey, let's sell the movie theater that's not doing as well?
Of course, they're always going to keep the best one.
Right. And so what winds up happening is the retail outlets that aren't faring as well usually get sold to a competitor or to somebody else, and then eventually struggle to such a point where many times they go out of business.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. And then the remaining company becomes stronger because they have better locations, better screens, newer facilities, and so on.
Yeah, but I kind of look at it and say, so you think you're punishing AMC when in reality you're actually letting them get rid of movie theaters they probably would love to get rid of anyway.
What would be stopping them before?
Well, I mean, it doesn't look really,
it does look good when you call and say, this is a bad location, we got to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you don't want to turn the market over, though, to other competitors. So you kind of, you know, if you're breaking even in a place or it's not faring as well, you might just keep it open just to keep a footprint in that particular market.
Mm-hmm. So you woke up today, Sperling, you came back from your vacation. You probably had 40,000 emails in your list. Did you get an email from me?
I did, actually. I got a couple. One was about the Apprentice.
A request for money.
Yes, as usual. But one was about The Apprentice and Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, we're not going to talk about. But the other was, I got this newsletter from you.
Isn't that exciting? That's right. My Book Filter newsletter. We just launched it this week, a weekly newsletter talking about the best books of the week. So, you know, check out a link in our show notes, check our Twitter feed and, you know, sign up for the newsletter so you can find out about the best books of the week without having to listen to 45 minutes of this show or remember to go to the Book Filter website. So if you've ever read a book or think you might want to read a book in the future, even if you don't know how to read, sign up for the Book Filter newsletter and then share it with your friends.
Well, now that means it must be time for our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And Michael, each week you pick a book that you've selected with our listeners in mind. What is it this week?
That's right. I seem to become a development assistant now with what I'm doing here. I think what would be a really good property? And I don't know that it's even available. It might already be picked up. But my pick this week is Mrs. Sherlock Holmes by Brad Ricca. It's a nonfiction memoir, a work of history. And it's really ripe for turning into a movie or a TV series or a miniseries. It's about Grace Humiston. I've never heard of her. Have you ever heard of her?
Yes, about 5.5 seconds ago.
Yes, you did. At one point, she was the most famous woman in America. She died in 1948, but in the early 1900s, she was a crusading woman who made history repeatedly. She went to NYU Law School and graduated when women didn't do that. She finished her 3-year course in 2 years, ranked 7th in her class, and probably annoyed all the guys in her class. She was the first woman to become a district attorney in the entire United States. She founded the People's Law Firm, where she would here in New York City, where she would help defend immigrants and working class people. She went down south, risking her life to uncover the horrific abuses of peonage, which is slavery by another name. They would lure immigrants from overseas or up north down south onto plantations to work, and then those people would disappear. I mean, they would never be heard from again because they were basically slaves and they couldn't get out and couldn't get away. And she went down repeatedly and uncovered these abuses and helped bring that to light. But this book focuses on what happened in 1917. She was also a detective. And in 1917, she tackled the cold case of a young woman who'd gone missing and made tons of headlines all over the country because she was a young white woman with a wealthy father. And the trail led from New York to Italy and back again. And the police did nothing. They couldn't find out anything. And her father reached out to Grace Humiston. She tackled the case, did it for free, pro bono. And in like a week, she started to unravel the case. She brought the killer to justice. She showed the NYPD was either corrupt or incompetent, and the press dubbed her Mrs. Sherlock Holmes. And so this book, which is a lot of fun, focuses on that case in particular, but she's a really fascinating woman. I mean, you could have one season with this, one season down south with her undercover, one season with her in law school. She's got a great life story.
Would you call it Murder, She Wrote?
Maybe.
Well, if somebody...
That might be taken.
That's true. If it does get picked up, I guess that would be kind of we'd be able to toot our own horn.
It would be a big deal if they said we heard about it first on Book Filter and Showbiz Sandbox.
Oh, well, if that would be a big deal, what about some of these next stories that we're going to talk about? Because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, actually, Donald Trump really is good for business, especially if you're a cable news channel. Everyone had a good story to tell because it was the most watched year ever for Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. Apparently, if you were watching television, you were probably watching cable news.
Thank you, election year coverage.
Yes. Fox remains the leader in total viewers, the 25 to 54 demo, and in primetime. Heck, it even beat ESPN to be the most watched cable channel in primetime. It ranked number 5 in all channels behind the only the big 4 primetime networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, and Fox. CNN also had good news by gaining the most key viewers and beating Fox News for months on end in the 25 to 54 age group and narrowing the gap between the two substantially. Is this all a big deal or a big whoop? And when will Donald Trump take credit for all of it?
He already has, and it's a big deal. It is an election year, but when you set new highs, that's just always, you know ratings will go up, but to set a new high is really significant. Whether they can keep that momentum going, one assumes they will fall down a little bit, but they found a new audience is what Zucker is doing at CNN working. It seems to be at least in the ratings. We'll have to see what happens, but it's certainly a great way to start the new year if you're a cable news channel. God knows there's no money in print, so at least there's some money in TV.
Well, and Fox News just lost Megyn Kelly this morning.
Oh my God, really? I didn't see that.
She's going to NBC.
NBC.
Yes, where she'll have
like NBC. A, yes. Interesting.
What, you
so she'll be doing primetime specials and will she be hosting the nightly news?
I haven't had a chance to read it because we've been recording, of course.
Dear God, well, that's interesting. So she said not CNN. That's interesting. Because if you want to be a bigger player, you gotta do something different. And CNN would be like the number, why go from number one to number two?
Right.
I thought she would stay, I have to admit.
Yeah, so did
Didn't
I.
Didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, she is literally between Bill O'Reilly, Megyn Kelly, and Sean Hannity. It's like, you know, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. You know, that's the primetime lineup, and she has a huge audience there.
So they say she's going to host a new 1 hour daytime program. Daytime. Now, they already have 4 hours a day on Today, so it's not clear whether she's going to be like the 9 to 10 hour or something like that on Today show, whether it will follow that or whether it'll be an afternoon thing. But that's interesting. She'll also anchor a new Sunday evening news magazine, like a Dateline. So it'll be the Megyn Kelly Report. Sunday nights, why not? That's the most watched night of the week at times. And, of course, the NBC will use her all over the place on NBC News and political and special events coverage. So that's a big, big news. So that's very interesting.
Donald Trump also taking credit for that, saying that okay. Before me, nobody knew about Megyn Kelly bigly.
Yeah, all right, here we go.
All right, well, we did kind of mention the whole Directors Guild thing. You know, the board of the DGA, which is known as the Directors Guild, has approved a new contract with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, and they sent it out to members for approval. Details are starting to emerge, and the key one is that the DGA scored an increase in residuals for streaming video on demand, and they did that with the AMPTP. No surprise, since that's where all the action is. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You don't like strikes, and you want people to be able to be reasonable. That's where the money is. You have to give them more money. There's no other, you know, to fight and argue about that is crazy. What the level should be, of course, but you've got to acknowledge reality. And the reality is that streaming is where the money is, and therefore they deserve a bigger cut.
Right. And the DGA has 16,000 members. They make movies and television shows. And the new agreement, nobody really knows what the actuals are, so to speak.
Yeah, it hasn't leaked out yet too much.
Right. But they're talking about, the three times the amount of money from streaming services.
Huh, wow.
According to a new study backed by FX, peak TV just hit a new, peak. In 2016, the number of scripted series rose to 455, a jump of 34 more shows compared to 1 year earlier. Online services like Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon created 93 of those shows. In 2006, just one decade ago, the number of scripted series was a mere 192.
Wow.
Obviously, yeah, no, much, much less. Obviously, this figure includes some co-productions or airings of shows that began overseas. Also, scripted refers to sitcoms and dramas and other hybrids, but does not include reality shows, many of which do include scripted dialogue scenes and storylines. But still, with 455 shows airing, what's the best TV show of the year? Nobody knows. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a heck of a lot of shows. And you compare that to movies. There are 336 movies eligible for Oscar this year. And you can actually watch every single one of them. You know, that's one a day. That's very doable. Roger Ebert would see two or three or four movies a day sometimes. TV, you have to watch the entire season. There's no chance. You cannot know what the best show of the year is. It's impossible.
Yeah, I just started watching Westworld. And I'm like, oh,
golly. Yes. And one of those shows next year will be Will and Grace. They're coming back, it looks like, for 10 episodes. But one of the shows won't be the ANC documentary series Escaping the KKK. That's because it maybe was a little scripted, which it shouldn't have been. It's blown up in their face, but it happened all over the holidays so completely. It's a great story, but you know what? Whatever. We'll wait till we find out what actually was going on.
Tupac Shakur has become only the fourth hip-hop act to join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's something I didn't expect you to say today. Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, who knew? Six new inductees were announced, including Pearl Jam, Journey, Yes, Electric Light Orchestra, and Joan Baez. Indeed, Baez is just the third woman in the last 4 years to be inducted. The only thing the Hall is warier of than hip-hop may be women and dance music. Chic nominated, but shut out for the 11th time. That's unbelievable. Though a panel did choose to honor Nile Rodgers with a special career award, that's not really a good consolation prize. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for the people involved. Journey doesn't belong on the list. All the others are defensible. Why Sheik is not on there, I don't know. That's crazy.
Well, I read this interesting article by one of the voters who, I think it was in Vulture, who was basically saying, look, this is the same problem that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the folks who do the Academy Awards, same problem is that the people that vote on this are actually, you know, much older and mostly white. And so they like 1980s, rock, you know, pure rock groups, i.e. Journey. Yes.
Well, that's 70s. Yeah, but they're older. That means that they were around when Sheik was a big deal. I mean, they're industry people. They know how important Nile Rodgers and Sheik are. So, oh well. But yeah, the, certainly dance and our dance music and disco never got a lot of love from the critics or from rock and roll people. Nowadays, we acknowledge the fact that how important and influential they are, but that certainly wasn't the case early on.
Yeah, and you know, I thought it was interesting. There's always some controversy here with the picks. And this year, it's Pearl Jam's drummer. The problem with Pearl Jam and drumming is that they've had like four or five different drummers. However, one drummer, Dave, I can't pronounce his last name, Abruzzese, he was there for 10, but then, you know, which was their big breakout first debut album. It's the one that has, you know, like every song's a hit. It's got Jeremy and Alive and Once and all these big, big albums. He's being left out.
Right. I mean, and usually, they go with the original lineup or the most significant lineup. And that's still their biggest selling album by far, I think. So he feels a little left out. And, it's hard. Some people say, hey, why not just let anybody who's had a substantial recording and constantly stand on stage? You know, whatever. Who cares?
Yeah. And I take it back. Dave Abruzzese actually was there for some of the other albums, Versus and Vitalogy. So after they kind of broke out with Dave Crewson, who really only appeared on the one album, the first breakout debut album, 10, he appeared on that, and then he left the band due to, you know, kind of being, you know, some alcohol dependency.
He left. Doesn't matter.
And then Abruzzese was hired, and he played on Versus and Vitalogy, their next albums, which were huge successes, and he was left out.
I see. So they went with the original lineup.
The original lineup and the lineup as it is today.
Yeah. So the guy in the middle was left out. It's a bummer. It's difficult. These things always come up because bands, when they exist for 30 or 40 years, they don't remain the same.
That's right. Now, if you want to win a BAFTA for Best British Film, Michael, or Best British Debut, do you want to?
I do.
Sure. Well, then your movie better be diverse. The BAFTAs announced that UK films will have to prove diversity in at least two key ways in order to be eligible for their top prizes. Movies must be diverse in their on-screen characters and themes, diverse in top crew members, diverse in training and industry progression, i.e. mentoring and the like, audience access, and appeal. The BAFTAs have also dropped the requirement that new members must be recommended by two existing members, something that AMPAS has. This comes on top of a film funding initiative by the BFI, which also pushed for diversity. Films will be eligible in all other categories like acting, and the rules do not apply to movies up for best film overall. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It applies to the best British film, best British debut. That's a hugely useful and important award to win at the BAFTAs. And you got to put your money where your mouth is. They're saying, hey, look, you know, some stories are going to be about elderly white women in a nursing home. But behind the scenes, here and there, you got to make these changes. If we don't push and fight for this, it's not going to happen. I think they're reasonable requirements. There's lots of different ways to fulfill it. You want good, diverse crews so you can tell diverse stories and bring diverse lives on screen. It's better for the industry. The more talent pool you have, the better you're going to do.
Let's face it. Big companies hate unions. Why? Because they'd rather negotiate with individual employees who, of course, have precious little bargaining power than with a union that represents many employees and thus has a lot of power. The DGA, we just said, represents 16,000 directors. That's true in every industry, even the liberal enclave of publishing. So when Penguin Random House in the UK said it was de-recognizing unions, alarm bells went off around the world. Now more than 140 top authors have called out PRH and urged them to come to an agreement with the two major trade unions they did business with before the massive merger into the biggest publisher in the world. Remember, they were all different. It was Random House and Penguin. PRH insists it's not about saving money or preserving current worker conditions, but simply that the unions were making onerous new demands. The union and the people they represent say that's not true, and pretty much every outside observer agrees with them. So is this a big deal or a big what, Michael? You're in this business.
Well, to long story short, I wish I were in the business. Penguin Random House is trying to crack down and get a better deal with unions, and they're trying to de-recognize them. And liberal authors went, people really paid attention. It didn't happen. You know, it's overseas, but artists all over the world are paying attention, and they spoke up. They spoke about the irony, the company that handles George Orwell talking about de-recognizing somebody, or a company that sells the classic worker rights book, The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, which is something every UK socialist would know, being the same company that wants to not do business with a union is kind of ironic. They're backing off a little bit. They insist that this is not what they were doing. They are now sort of having some talks, but people are looking, they're paying attention, and we'll have to see where it ends up. But it's definitely a big deal because it's the biggest publishing company in the world. And you can see that fight is never ending. Our friend Zoe, who's been on the show before or is a longtime viewer and talked about being a casting director, she was there on Broadway on the opening night of In Transit, the last show to open up on Broadway this fall. And she was there handing out leaflets to people with other members of the casting director people, trying to get casting directors recognized on Broadway and become part of the basic benefits package that almost everyone else working on a Broadway show has a part of.
It's all a matter of perspective. You can say the EU is in a fight to the death with cord cutting and holding it off, or you can say traditional pay TV is bigger than ever. So take that, OTT! In fact, gross cable revenue in the EU was 22.4 billion euros for all of 2015, up from the year before.
Yay!
Increased competition from OTT and digital services meant traditional companies were investing in infrastructure, adding better services, and including Netflix alongside more traditional channels. The result? Happy, or at least happier, customers. Yeah, take note, American cable companies. Big deal or big whoop.
Exactly. I mean, cord cutting is a myth. The idea that kids don't care about TV, they didn't have a TV in college, they don't want to watch TV, they're fine with just Netflix, that's malarkey. People want TV, they watch as much now than they ever did. They just don't want to pay through the nose for it. And in North America, they've been raising prices for 30, 40 years because there's no competition. It's been way past the rate of inflation. And when people have other options, like a skinny bundle or OTT or multiple channels that will do them okay, they say, well, you know what? If I have Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, now I'm starting to feel maybe I don't need that cable bill. They're going to do it. So you got to provide better service. You got to provide skinny bundles. You got to provide, you know, better Wi-Fi speeds. So, you know, it's real that people do want to cut the cord, but what they're cutting is their cable bill.
Well, and over the break, during the New Year's week, NBC Universal kind of got into it with Charter Spectrum, and Charter Spectrum is the former Time Warner Cable and Charter combined. So it's a huge, huge organization. Now, NBC Universal wanted to, you know, kind of up their retransmission fees for, you know, Charter and Spectrum members subscribers. And now remember, I'm a Spectrum subscriber. I can't opt out and subscribe to another cable company except for maybe DirecTV, which is not cable, it's satellite. So,
right, same thing in New York, which is also a major market for Time Warner, what was Time Warner Cable.
So, for instance, if NBC Universal really kind of stuck it to Spectrum and said, look, I'm sorry, we just want more, and we're taking all of our channels, there's like, you know, CNBC and all these different channels that they have, we're just taking them with us, and I'm sorry, but we're going to black you out until we come to an agreement. They could have done that. And the interesting thing here is that the last retransmission agreement was negotiated under General Electric, okay, when General Electric owned NBC Universal. Now, guess what? Guess who owns them now? Comcast, their competitor, Spectrum's competitor in the cable business.
Because NBC wasn't involved in cable previously, right? So you've got two competitors, one saying, I want more money from you. Yeah.
Yeah, basically NBC Universal was not a cable provider before that. Now, right, one cable provider can stick it to another cable provider by not providing the content.
So what's happening? They extended the deadline. Had a showdown, but they did not black out channels. They're still talking. They're still negotiating and hoping to come to an agreement.
Correct. I just wanted to point it out because, you know, when everybody says, oh, you know, it's not going to really matter and everybody's going to play nice. No, exactly what we said would happen is happening. Like, literally exactly what we thought would happen is happening with their own channels. So,
of course. Yeah, absolutely. And by God, we want to see Megyn Kelly, so we have to have NBC.
That's right. Gosh darn it. We only knew that starting this morning, but still. Remember when the company that owned Pokemon saw its stock soar after it released a mobile version that was hugely popular? Do you remember that, Michael? It was just like, you know, a couple months ago.
I remember it.
Well, even though it didn't directly own Pokemon Go, just a stake in the company that owned the game, turns out the opposite can happen. Nintendo has seen its stock fall 11% in a week after it released a new mobile version of its Super Mario franchise. Dubbed Super Mario Run, it costs a very pricey $10, and the thousands of reviews by gamers have been brutally bad. Not about the game itself, but the price. Typically, users pay tiny little fees to open up more gaming options. Paying $10 all at once gave people sticker shock. The game had 25 million downloads in 4 days, but the number of people converting to the paid model after sampling is a very low 8%. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, not because this isn't going great, but because to change people's habits is really, really hard. They say, look, we just want you to pay $10 up front and then you can do anything you want. And they're like, no, I want to pay 50 cents here and 75 cents there. That's the way they've been doing it. People don't like change. Whether this is better for them or whether this was just a poorly thought out plan, I don't know, because I don't play mobile games enough to be aware of that. But look, gaming worldwide is a $91 billion market. Mobile is $41 billion, retail is $26 billion, free-to-play, where they have advertising and stuff, I guess, is another $19 billion. And then you can toss in another $5 billion from virtual reality and esports and more stuff that is growing pretty well. So it's a big market. It matters a lot. Whether this is the wave of the future or they were trying to change habits and they failed, I don't know.
I think this is pure product management, meaning when you're managing a release like this, you have to know how to price it. You have to know how to release it. And they said, oh, let's just charge $10 instead of doing a, you know,
this. Well, it was a conscious choice to try and change how people relate to the games and how they pay for them and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it wasn't like they casually did this. I assume this was with their big name brand guy. They said, look, this is the new way. We think this is a better way to do it. Whether it's better for consumers too, I don't know. Obviously, they're unhappy about it because it's not the way things have been done. But do you have a sense of whether it's a bad attempt? Or, I mean, it wasn't a lazy, let's just do it this way.
Well, no. I mean, part of some of the people I spoke with who played the game said, when you're playing it, you notice how there were obvious levels where they wanted you to kind of pay up to get to the next level. But instead, they just said, okay, no, just pay us all at once. So, they kind of changed tact in releasing the product.
Okay.
So, you know, I guess now they learned, hey, maybe we should either start from the very beginning and know how much it's going to cost. And maybe $10 is a little too much. Or, keep it the way we had intended by kind of doing a freemium model.
Okay.
Now, when does a case go to the Supreme Court, Michael? Well, one good sign is when you see different rulings in different states all contradicting each other and creating confusion in the marketplace. That's why the latest round in a court case between satellite radio company SiriusXM and members of the Turtles will likely keep winding its way to the highest court in the land. The Turtles, big rock group, what was in the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm, mostly.
Yeah, they first won a ruling that said there was a state-level copyright for their music to be found in California, okay? So they said in California, our music is under copyright. In a case in New York, a judge sided with SiriusXM. A third case is taking place in Florida, where SiriusXM also has the upper hand. The conflicting claims about whether a 1972 act by Congress wiped away any potential state copyrights is a great big mess. And the Supreme Court will need to clear it up so artists and radio can be happy together once again.
Big deal. I see what you did there.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because it's the middle stage. We haven't had a resolution yet. It looks clear it's going to go to the Supreme Court because, like you say, it's a classic example where you've got different interpretations happening in every state around the country, and it's got to be resolved. Everybody's arguing about whether you can have a copyright for music from pre-1972. After Congress ruled, everybody said, all right, anything pre-72, you have certain rights that you can do with that music and you don't have to pay the artist. You can play it on the radio. You can do this, that, and the other thing. Turtles found a loophole mind you, it's 40, 50 years later. And they said, wait a second. In California, we've got this copyright. The satellite radio companies say, hey, no fair. If you had this right, why did you wait so long? And now state by state, we're getting all these conflicting rulings. It's a great big mess, like you say. It's got to go to the Supreme Court so this can get cleared up once and for all.
Right. And when it does get cleared up, all state copyright will go away.
Yeah.
All, you know, that's the issue right now is pre-1972, everybody's going back to the state. That would be a mess. That would be a huge mess. And it does not work. Now, it may have worked when every radio station was owned in state by a specific person in that state. And then, you know, that worked. But now, you know, we have national organizations that own these radio stations. And one Sirius XM that is a national organization, you just can't do it.
I don't know. I've never understood why. Oh, it's so confusing with different state sales tax and different. It's just a program in your thing. And you say, if in this state, then you put this rate. If in that state, you put that rate. It's 50 different rates. It's pretty simple to me, it seems. It's not like you have to figure it out all over again. It's 4.2 here. It's 4.7 in that state. It's 4.9 in that state. I mean, I don't understand why it would be so complicated in the day of automation.
Yeah, it's a big pain.
It's billing. It's billing. If it's in California, you pay this sales tax. If it's in New York, you pay that sales tax. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, they'd rather not deal with it. I understand, yes. But yeah.
Well, speaking of music, it's official. Worldwide, the music industry made more money from digital sales and streaming than physical product. Take that, you upstart vinyl. With Spotify joined by major streaming services pushed by Apple and Amazon, suddenly those digital dimes are beginning to add up. Take Warner Music. It announced revenue of $3.25 billion, its biggest total in 8 years. Streaming accounted for $1 billion of that, which is $100 million more than physical sales and more than double digital download sales. Worldwide, some 90 million people subscribe to streaming services worldwide. So obviously, there's a lot of room for growth. Big deal or big whoop?
I wasn't able to figure out that 90 million. Does that include people who are on the freemium level? No?
No.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to get people to add a monthly fee to their bill, but with 7-8 billion people, you definitely have a lot of room to grow, don't you? Do you feel like there's more people to add in? Because if you can double that number, now you're talking about maybe you'll start to really make up for the losses that they've seen from their peak days of compact discs.
Yeah. And look, we said that on this show that, you know, I had talked to record company executives that said, of course, streaming isn't making us any money right now. It's not supposed to until it reaches at least 50 million people. As soon as it does, then we'll start seeing some numbers. Sure enough, 90 million people and everybody's saying, hey, we're seeing some numbers here. In fact, it's changing the way, you know, records get made. The Black Keys recently put their music on Spotify. Radiohead did the same thing. So, you know, people...
Right, if your music isn't there, your music isn't being heard.
Exactly. And so I think what will wind up happening is right now we're talking about less than 1% of the Earth's population subscribing to one of these services, yeah. Right? So I think as time goes on, less music will be available on physical media and you'll either have to buy it digitally and download it digitally or you'll say, you know what, just forget it. I'll just rent it since it's digital anyway, and I'm never going to touch it. I may as well just rent it. And in that case, all of these streaming services will begin to attract more and more customers.
I think it's a little bit more than 1% because 80 million, 8 billion people on the planet, that would be 1%.
Okay. So
8 billion, 800 million, 80 million. However, the point is once they start to make more money, even if they don't ever match that peak years of compact disc, they also need to start paying more money to the songwriters and the artists and the people who create it. And that's not what they're doing yet. So now there needs to be a big fight over the royalty rates that people get.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Patrick Carney of the Black Keys said, look, you know, Daniel Ek, the founder of Spotify, is worth $3 billion, which is way more than Paul McCartney. And Daniel Ek has never written a song.
He's tone deaf.
Yeah. So, you know, I get that. I mean, they're different businesses, but still.
Well, but the heads of most companies, most record labels make more money than most of their artists. And that doesn't really, it's not really a telling comment. But the point is, if you're playing, making money off Paul McCartney's music, he deserves to get more than 0.000004 cents a play when that adds up to about $50 a year.
Correct.
Because where they're making money is not on streaming. It's not on album sales. Where are artists making money?
On merchandise. No, actually.
Yes.
On merchandise. Yeah. They are making money on tour, personal appearances. And last year, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band had the top grossing tour, along with Beyonce, barely beating out Beyonce.
an acclaimed memoir for Bruce Springsteen, and a massive best-selling world tour where he was highlighting The River, an album that came out 35 years ago. So a pretty damn good year for Bruce. I mean, that's got to be one of his highest grossing years since Born in the USA, if not ever.
Yeah, I mean, and his ticket prices are actually relatively low.
Yeah, for most of the tickets. I mean, he does have a I don't know what his average is.
$111.48.
Yeah, so that's, yeah, but that's a lot of his tickets are lower. So he's closer to the working man model than the Rolling Stone and Beyonce model.
Yeah, well, the Rolling Stones, I think, they're up there. The Stones are $122.33, and the top average ticket price went to Celine Dion at $146.26.
That's right. So we're talking about big acts touring the world. Springsteen and his band made $270 million worldwide. Beyonce made about $260 million. Coldplay, $240 million. Guns N' Roses, $190 million. That's how anticipated their reunion was. Adele, $170 million. That's the top five. So the top 10 tours alone grossed a combined $1.67 billion. That's a good jump over 2015, which was $1.5 billion. So about $170 million more. It's an 11% increase. So just like back in the 50s and 60s, you didn't sell 10 million copies of your album, but you went on tour and people saw you, and that's where the artists made their money. It doesn't mean they shouldn't make money with sales, but that's how it was in the old days, and that's how it is again.
Well, where are people going to be making money on Broadway? That's what we're going to be talking about during Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Let's start off by talking about Broadway hitting a $1.37 billion box office in 2016.
Thank you, Hamilton.
Yes. With $3 million a week from 8 performances, that's not bad. It's doubling the top ticket price, by the way. So,
They're from 400 to 500 to almost 1,000 is the top ticket price for Hamilton, and that's without the original stars in the show. And people are paying it.
I know, unbelievable. $105 million. The Lion King coming in just behind at $103 million last year. Wicked. That's been around for more than a decade. $89 million last year. Aladdin, $78 million, proving Disney can clean it up both in movies and in theater. Book of Mormon made $70 million last year.
That's right. Those are the top earners, but it was a strong year overall for all of Broadway, and we've got a bunch more shows coming out in the spring.
Indeed, Broadway is heating up with record grosses, as we just mentioned, and a lot of shows set to debut this winter and spring before the Tony deadlines. Remember, Tonys are in June, so all of these shows, kind of just like the awards season in movies is in December, well, guess what? Winter and spring, that's the awards season for theater. We'll ignore star-studded limited runs and look at just the big shows with open-ended runs, and we'll ask one question of our guest, Michael. Would Michael invest or not invest in it? I don't know why I just called you our guest.
Am I a guest?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Is this my last show? Have I been fired?
You're terminated.
Oh, God.
All right, so we have 16 shows here, let's start with Jitney. It opens January 19th. It's the final August Wilson play to debut on Broadway. First in the cycle that he wrote. All star casts includes John Douglas Thompson. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
Oh my God, I love August Wilson. I can't wait to see this show. I will not invest.
I could understand.
Why? Because it is a revival. August Wilson is one of the most produced playwrights in America right now. Only Shakespeare had more plays produced in regional theaters and professional productions around the country. He's hugely popular and will be for many years to come. I think he's easily one of America's greatest playwrights, if not the greatest. But this is a revival, so you're not going to get a piece of that show as it gets produced around the country over the many years. If this was a new August Wilson play, I would invest. But because it's a revival and you're only going to get a piece of this particular production, I don't think it's going to work commercially.
Okay, let's move on to Significant Other, opening March 2nd. This is a new comedy by Joshua Harmon, the author of Bad Jews. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
I will not invest. I'm still sorry I missed Bad Jews. I know people loved it. I didn't get to see it. This one, I had friends who saw it off Broadway, and they weren't crazy about it. So the you have a good review from the Times, and that's what matters most. But I'm feeling uneasy about it, and I'm not going to invest.
I feel like I saw Bad Jews at the Geffen Playhouse.
I'm sure you did. It toured all over the country. It was very popular. This one is a newer play. It's just probably not as good.
Oh, I did see this. It just goes to show you, I see so much that I can barely remember it sometimes.
And of course, all these shows, if you're an actual investor, of course, you would be able to sit in with a meeting, you'd read the play, you'd see a production, you would have people perform numbers. If it was a musical, you'd maybe get a copy of the CD to hear a bunch of the songs. So we are judging it from afar. But the metrics of like how big the show is, how much it costs, what kind of stars you have, the talent involved, those remain the same. And sometimes it's easier to judge when you're not in the room.
Yes, and if you want to know how that whole investing goes, just watch the hit television show on NBC, Smash! Okay, Come From Away is a play, it's a musical that opens on March 12th, a musical about 9/11 in which planes were diverted to a small town in Canada, and the locals and travelers all came together to offer shelter and community. The director is Christopher Ashley. The book, music, and lyrics are by Broadway newbies Irene Sankoff and David Hein.
I have to invest because my mom loves the book that this is based on. This is a show that's played regionally. It played in Canada. There's a nonfiction book, which isn't very good, but people love it and keep reading it. It's just a nice, happy story out of 9/11. God knows you want that. But from looking at how it was reviewed, it seems like this is a show with a low production cost. I mean, the cost to put it on week to week, it looks very simple. It's not elaborate. It's like chairs and props. And I think it will be easy to do regionally if it's a success on Broadway. And there's just a real word of mouth, heartwarming nature to the show. And the big reason as well is that it's very similar to a musical called The Band's Visit, starring Tony Shalhoub, which is the best musical I saw last year, practically one of the two or three best. It just opened at the end of the year, but it's not transferring to Broadway this season. If it had, I would have said those shows are too similar and I would only put my money in The Band's Visit. But I think this is a good low-cost bet. I don't think it's a big budget, relatively speaking, and I think it's going to have good word of mouth, and it's a real gamble, a real roll of the dice, but I'm going to go for it.
So The Band's Visit, based on it was an Israeli or Palestinian film.
Israeli film. Yeah. Lovely film. One of my favorites of that year. And the show was terrific, too. Really great.
Miss Saigon opens March 23rd, its first revival. It says it's closing in January of 2018 for a national tour. Right. If it's grossing $2 million a week, there's no chance in hell they'll close that thing. Remember Motown, by the way, that was only supposed to be there for, and I think it's still playing. The star turn, by the way, for newcomer Ava, you don't want me to pronounce that, do you?
Will you? Ava Noblezada, I think, maybe?
Yeah, thank you for doing that for me. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
It could be Noblezada, I don't know. I will not invest. The reference to Motown was the fact that Motown said, oh, we'll come back. You know, you go on tour and then we'll come back to Broadway. That didn't work. So if you're on Broadway and you're making money, I don't believe for a second they're going to shut it down. I'm not investing because I hate the show.
Okay.
And it opened in London. And this girl, Ava Noblezada, however one says her name, I apologize. She performed at an annual awards thing here in New York where high school students get and do a show.
Oh my gosh, I remember this. Yes.
Yeah, I've talked about it. It's really fun. It's really cool. You see some young talent. She came up like 3 years ago. She's a high school student. She sang a number from Miss Saigon. A producer was in the audience and said, get me that girl. And they flew her to London and she opened on the West End in the show. She went from high school to playing that character in the West End. That's amazing. And she did great in it. It's just a show I don't like. And it's not running anymore in London. And I think, you know what? There's a reason.
Yeah.
And I just don't trust it. And the fact that they say we're going to close it in January, I think that shows a lack of confidence. They think they're saying creating demand, but I just don't trust it.
Okay. Sweat opens March 26th. This is a Broadway transfer of the public theater drama by Pulitzer Prize winner Lynn Nottage, who wrote the amazing Ruined. And it's the travails of working class people in a factory town. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
I will not invest because I saw it at the Public and I hated it.
Oh, okay.
I loved Ruined, and that's a terrific show, a really unlikely success story as far as what it's about.
Oh,
it played all over the country. It should have opened on Broadway and it didn't. This one I saw and I didn't like it, but it got good reviews from everyone else. So I'm way out on the edge here on this one. But, you know, if you see a show and you don't like it and thought the ending sucked, you know, why would you invest in it?
Well, and you may be wondering, why are we covering things that are only on Broadway? Well, guess what? Ruin played all over the world.
Absolutely.
Now, The Play That Goes Wrong opens April 2nd. Why would you invest in something that tells you right off the bat? Well, it's a British comedy a la Noises Off. The last time a British comedy scored in New York, James Corden became a star. The reviews were very good. Will you invest or not invest, Michael?
I wish I'd seen it. It's a young cast. It probably doesn't cost a lot to put on. British comedy doesn't usually translate, but something in my heart tells me theater lovers are going to love it, and I'm going to roll the dice and be silly and say I will invest.
And yet, if it goes south, you have nobody to blame but yourself.
They told you.
They told you in the name of the play. Okay, now here's one. One of my favorite movies is Amelie, and Amelie the musical opens April 3rd. It stars Philippe Bossu of Hamilton and Here Lies Love. It's based on the movie, as I just mentioned. Daniel Messi, is it Messi or Messa?
I don't know.
Well, he is of the band Hem and Nathan Tyson. He is the lyricist for Tuck Everlasting. Are you going to invest or not invest, Michael?
I am not investing. Okay. I just don't feel a lot of excitement for this. I think the charm of the show, they're not trying to recreate the movie, so that's a good move because the movie is all about the kinetic camera work and that sort of crazy loopy vibe that it created. I'm not feeling it. It's been staged twice. It's gotten some very encouraging reviews, but I'm just not feeling the excitement about it, and I'm going to step away.
And having seen it, that's kind of the way I felt. It was like, Oh, yeah, it's a nice little bonbon, but... Okay, War Paint opens April 6th, and I don't know if you noticed this, but our last three shows here that we've talked about, April 2nd, April 3rd, now War Paint, April 6th, Patti LuPone and Chris...
April gets very, very crowded.
Yeah. Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersol as warring makeup icons Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein, the composing team behind Grey Gardens. So it's a top-notch creative team. Will you invest or not invest, Michael?
It's all about the big stars of this show, but I loved Grey Gardens. They got Christine Ebersol a Tony when she did that show. Or was it the mom her mother that won the Tony? I think this is going to have a long run and a long history with being great showcases for divas of a certain age. So I think it's a valuable property. It sounds like it's fun. And even though they're the big names involved, I think it's going to have a good afterlife. And because I'll have a piece of that, that's my assumption that when it tours in regional productions, I am going to invest.
Oslo opens April 13th. It's a highly acclaimed Lincoln Center drama about secret talks between Israel and the PLO in Oslo in 1993. Invest or not invest, Michael?
Well, you had me at secret talks between Israel and PLO. I will not invest.
Okay.
I wish I'd seen it. Got great reviews. I'm looking forward to it. Doesn't sound like you're going to make tons of money, but it's already being staged around the country, so who knows?
Groundhog Day opens April 17th. It opened in the UK to great reviews, starring Andy Carl of Rocky, the composer of Matilda. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
I will invest. My mom saw it and my sister saw it. They both liked it. Great reviews, a brand name thing, Andy Carl becoming a star. I'm investing.
Groundhog Day opens April. No, just kidding.
That was good.
Indecent opens April 18th. Broadway transfer for Paula Vogel of the play. The play is about the theater and mounting of a Yiddish play about running a brothel that shocked way back in 1922. So I guess it's a revival. I guess the real shock was lesbian romance. I don't know. Michael, will you invest or not invest?
I will not invest. The people I know who saw it off Broadway, I mean, Paula Vogel's a talent and it got good reviews, but the people I know who saw it were not excited by it. It sounds like a tough sell. I'm not going to go for it. And you really, it's unfair because you can't go wrong saying no to a play. You can't go wrong saying no to most shows because most shows don't make money.
Hello, Dolly opens April 20th and it stars Bette Midler. Can we just skip this one? You're going to invest, right? I mean,
I'm absolutely investing, though it's bloody Scott Rutan. So do you want to invest? He'll be like, give me $4 million. You get 0.001%. You can thank me later. You know? So maybe my terms won't be that good. So maybe I won't invest. And of course, it's all about how long she's in it for, though. Will they have other stars lined up to take over that will be just as big? Perhaps. I would see. I would see Queen Latifah doing Hello, Dolly. That would be great.
That's true.
I think it's a money in the bank while she's there, no doubt about it.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory opens April 23rd. It stars Christian Borle. Oh, wow. Revamped. It's a revamped production from London. Michael, are you going to invest or not invest?
Absolutely not. What is the point of doing it in one country, seeing it's terrible and it's already closed? And you say, yeah, but we'll fix it. people really find it hard to walk away from a property, whether they're doing it in Chicago or Toronto or London. It's like, it didn't work. I don't think it's going to work. It doesn't sound like they've done the work to make it that dramatically better. So no, thank you.
Anastasia opens April 24th because, you know, no new shows have opened in April. My gosh. It's based on the animated film with new songs added in by composing teams Ahrens and Flattery. It's a good creative team. Will you invest or not?
I will not invest. This is right up to the Tony deadline. I think the end of April is when you have to have your show open so you can be eligible for that year's Tony. This sounds like a show where they said, hey, you know, animated movies are being turned into musicals. What do we got? Oh, Aaron's and Flaherty. They did great work. They did on Once on This Island and some other great shows. I never loved the movie. I don't feel there's any huge yearning desire, but it is a name brand story. Anastasia, you know, the Russian princess. They are a good team. Maybe they've created some great new songs. If they show me five new songs that were better than every song in the movie, I might be won over. But it just feels like they looked around for a property that hadn't been done yet.
Just a few days later, on April 26th, Bandstand will open. It stars Laura Osnes and Corey Cott. It's a post-World War II
tale. I love them both, by
the way. They're great.
No. I love them. I love them both.
Okay. Well, I think they're also talented.
No, they're really talented, yeah.
Yeah. This one is a post-World War II tale of veterans who try to score with big band music. Michael, invest or not invest?
Well, you know, I really want to. I saw it at the Paper Mill Playhouse, where it was the world premiere of this show with these two stars attached. It wasn't quite there yet. I gave them good notes in my reviews. If they follow my advice, they could have turned it around and made it a great show. It was pretty fun. They're both very appealing. I'd really need to see the work that they've done and know what they've revamped. I feel like it's just a tad anonymous. And I'm worried that it's just not going to go over. But I do like them, and I'll be rooting for them. But at the moment, without hearing new songs and what they've changes they've made, I am not going to invest.
Well, on April 27th, one of my favorite playwrights has a production opening, A Doll's House Part 2. Lucas Hanath, okay, is the playwright. He wrote The Christians. Stars Jane Houdyshell, Laurie Metcalf, Condola Rashad, and Chris Cooper will all star. And, well... You tell me, Michael, invest or not invest?
Well, this is Broadway. You're investing in Broadway musicals. You're not being an intelligent, hard-nosed investor. You're leading with your heart a lot of times. And well, the last thing you should do is invest in a play called A Doll's House Part 2, even though it's Lucas Hanath, one of my favorite playwrights. And it's a play. It's a drama. It's based on a play most people haven't seen, even though they've heard of it. I'm investing because I love them and I want to see it.
Okay.
And sometimes logic goes out the window when you're going to invest in a Broadway show.
Indeed, that's why you invested in a play called, what was the play called? The Play That Goes Wrong.
That's right.
But that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week and sadly moves us along into our obituary section. And I have to say, you know, 2016 was the kind of year where last night after the Rose Bowl, the big football game here in the U.S., I went to Twitter and Woody Allen was trending. And my first thought when I saw Woody Allen trending on Twitter was, oh my goodness, Woody Allen must have died. Okay, that's how bad 2016 was.
I don't think it's that 2016 was so bad. I think it's just that we're older.
Yes, I thought the same thing.
There's people that we've grown up with who are dying, even though they were 20 years older maybe or 15 years older when we were kids, but they were part of our lives for a long time. And every time somebody dies now, you're like, oh, geez, I knew them.
Right, exactly.
If they've died, I could die.
Exactly. I mean,
kids who are 20, I don't think they're going, why is everybody freaking out about the dead people? So old people died. So what?
Right. Who is this David Bowie anyway?
Leonard Cohen died. He was 110. I love him and I'm very sad that he died. But anyway, but he was in pain. So I'm glad he was able to be creative right up until the end. But yeah, we had a couple hard ones after even the great ones already of this year. Who were they?
Well, George Michael on Christmas Day died of what is believed to be heart failure at 53 years old. Of course, the pop singer who made his bones, has made his name, so to speak, with the pop group Wham.
And his solo work. It was his last Christmas, as people immediately texted. It really was his last Christmas.
That's true. That's one of his big songs.
One of his enduring songs. Terrific pop songwriter. It's very sad because he was so young and you felt like he still could have come back and done some more great music. It had been 20 years since he delivered some really great music. We knew he's had drug issues and a troubled life. I hope he died happily and in his sleep. And it was just a shame that... he accomplished a lot, but you just feel like there was a lot of untapped potential. He should have had a lot more great music. But, you know, those two or three or four albums from Wham and his first two solo albums are great. So, you know, he's going to endure at least with a clutch of greatest hits.
Well, and then this next one, of course, everybody's heard of around the world. Carrie Fisher died at 60. She landed here in Los Angeles on Christmas Eve and was having a heart attack or at least a cardiac issue. And she was hospitalized, never recovered, and died a couple days after Christmas. And just to really gut punch us, her mother, who was so much a part of her life, that Carrie Fisher's book, Postcards from the Edge, was a fictitious account of her life with Debbie Reynolds, died the very next day at the age of 84.
I called up my mother and I said, "What have you learned from Debbie Reynolds?" She's like, "What do you mean?" I go, "If I die, I expect you to collapse and die the very next day. And if you don't, you don't really love me." That's the message I took. Yes, Debbie Reynolds had been sick for a few years. She could have died at any time. The stress obviously was too much. It's very sad. It's an unhappy thing, of course. But it's not a shock that she would die. She could have, you know, she's the sort of person obituaries were already in place for. Bless her heart. Carrie Fisher, I don't think people had obituaries written for her. They were not ready for this. This was a shock.
Yeah, the write-aheads, I think they call them, you know.
Yeah, but in this case, I think Carrie Fisher might have, I'd like to think she would have rolled her eyes a little bit. I mean, any fan who missed her and wanted to pay tribute, but that's lovely. But like, you know, our princess is gone and stuff like that. I think that's the sort of thing she would have rolled her eyes and made a snarky comment about. She was always cool about the legacy of Star Wars. She was never, you know, like, "Oh, that stupid movie." She was cool about it, but you know, she's not our beloved, she's a funny, sharp, witty, wise woman. She's not our beloved princess. You know, she's not Princess Di, for God's sake. And I think she'd say, "Hey, what? Read one of my funny books and have a drink."
Right. It's interesting because, you know, she really didn't star in that many movies. Okay. She was a very well-known script doctor. Okay. But, you know, I guess, you know,
she was a great script doctor, a great humorist, a number of memoirs. She just had a new one. The Princess Diarist just came out a few weeks ago. And she's always the life of the party, a funny, funny person, a pioneer in bringing attention to some mental issues, and had a big annual party, her and Penny Marshall.
Yes.
Right. They shared the same birthday. And for years in Hollywood, getting invited to their house for their annual birthday party was a big deal. It was very, you know, I would have loved to attend it. It sounded like a blast.
Well, and, you know, actually, my personal story with Carrie Fisher actually includes Debbie Reynolds. And back in, I think it was 2009, Carrie Fisher did a show called Wishful Drinking at the Geffen Playhouse here in Los Angeles. And when I got to my seat at the Geffen Playhouse, I thought, "Ugh, this person in front of me. The hair, come on. And Carrie Fisher went on stage, and it's a one-woman show where she basically lays out her life and explains who everybody was. And it's very funny, hilarious. She read from teleprompters most of the time that were in the back of the auditorium. But she was working on the show, and I think it became an HBO special, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then afterwards, it was one of those talk back Tuesdays where, you know, if you stay after, you can talk to the cast. Well, normally everybody leaves. I mean, like, they head for the door faster than you could possibly imagine, you know, most of them running for the door. This time, of course, everybody stuck around. And sure enough, Carrie Fisher comes out. She starts addressing the audience's questions and she starts talking about her mom. And then she sees, oh, yeah. And there she is. She's the woman sitting in front of me with the big hair. Okay, so there's Debbie Reynolds. Eventually, Debbie Reynolds winds up on stage with Carrie Fisher talking. It was just unbelievable.
Of course she did.
Yeah, it was just...
There's a new documentary from HBO, which is going to air January 7th, I think, about their relationship. So, you know, they moved up the air date a little bit, but they've been working on it for a while. So that'll be a fun thing to see, I think. It's gotten some pretty good reviews. And The Hollywood Reporter had a good story talking about Debbie Reynolds and her memorabilia collection. She was an avid collector of Hollywood memorabilia. She thought, "This is our history. You shouldn't be throwing this away." She would, you know, she would constantly buy things, stuff from movies, and it became an obsession, really. She really became a serious collector, almost opened up a museum once or twice. And the really sad thing is she approached the Academy Library like multiple times. I shouldn't say the library, but the Academy, and said, I've got this great collection of Hollywood stuff. Do you want to buy it? And they refused. They never could get their act together and buy it. Would have been perfect for their museum. So it's a shame that that never happened. She eventually had to sell it off piecemeal because it just became too much. But an interesting, important collector of Hollywood memorabilia.
And Wesley Morris in the New York Times wrote a fantastic appreciation of Debbie Reynolds and the kind of star she was. And, you know, I do want to read this thing. It was fantastic. He wrote, "You got the sense that Miss Reynolds and Miss Fisher came to accept over the years their very public symbiosis, and that Miss Reynolds had a flair for the dramatic after all. They were relatives. They were neighbors. They made their exits a day apart. There was a moving human beauty in the extremity of that bond. They so couldn't live without each other that they couldn't die without each other either."
And that's exactly how I feel about you.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you very much. I mean, I thought that was, having seen that show and watched them, you know, interact, it really, yeah. When you heard the next day that Debbie Reynolds passed away, it was really like, wow, could this year please end? I mean, I know that that's not the reason people are dying, but it just really feels like, okay, enough already. I can't take anymore.
And isn't that the bond we have with our listeners?
Yes, indeed, it is, which is why we love it when you write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's exactly what James Gardner did. He sent me a picture of the Hollywood sign over New Year's Eve. I think it was New Year's Eve or
Hollyweed.
Hollyweed. Somebody changed the name to Hollyweed, which I thought was very humorous, in fact. So, James, thank you very much. You wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He also could have... although I don't know how he would have sent a picture via voicemail. But if you do want to leave us a voicemail, the number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace. Stitcher is another place. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find our podcast. And it does help us when you rate and review the show. So please do subscribe and rate and review the show. That information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, including the link to Michael's new newsletter for Book Filter. It's also where you'll find ways to, you can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page is you just search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. Again, that information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found at their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's "Have you signed up for my newsletter yet?" .com.
And actually, that may actually work to get you to some of the coverage of the entertainment industry that Michael writes. You could also find it on the Huffington Post, or it's aggregated at michaelgiltz.com. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.